That's 1 year of schooling for the hosts.
But now I lose that. So. I also had one of these.
On the bus again? The school bus.
Oh, okay.
Bus.
Yeah. That was at 78. So a commercial tells us to remind you not to go around buses that have the lights on.
Reminder to speak in the
room. We have the main audio guy today. I think Grant didn't know how to turn off the pot. So this is my guess. My guess is that they had the individual pots on the mics up, but didn't know how to.
I don't know, for some reason it got turned on to mono, and
that's my real one.
We need to be at the top. I mean, here was
it. That's why.
Chance is calling us?
That's what Denise said.
Sue is going to
put a trip.
Don't do that.
Within the next 3 minutes. She was on the phone with
a TV
chef.
Now you get to my open comment. Is a truck.
Thursday morning, so this must be Chester. I'd like to call to order this 36th meeting of the New Jersey Highlands Water Protection and Planning Council. My name is John Weingart. I live in Surgeonsville in Hunterdon County.
Judge Hyer, Morris County Freeholder.
Debbie Pascarelli, Greenwich Township, Warren County Representative.
Tracy Carluccio, Hunterdon County Public Representative.
Michael Salamara, Burnsville Councilperson, Somerset County.
Tiki Shaway, Passaic County Freeholder.
Tim Dillingham, I'm a public member. I'm from Mercer County.
Mimi Letts, Precipiny, Morris County.
Scott Whitenack, Morristown.
And Jazz Kovacs will be calling in shortly, and there are several other members who will be here later in the day. This meeting was advertised in accordance with the Open Public Meetings Act and publicized on the Highlands Council's website. All who wish, please rise to the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
In our packets is the minutes from last week's meeting, as well as the summary of public comments from last week's meeting. You'll find there were eight people who commented during that session, and their comments are summarized. And attached to that summary are several documents. There's some regulations that were referenced by one of the commenters, and there is a written comment from another one of the commenters. Is there a motion for the minutes?
I'll move approval of the minutes.
I have a
motion. Is there a second?
One correction to the public availability session. The last full big paragraph, the fourth line begins with advised that if anyone feels they are not being summarized correctly, I believe it should say.
Oh, yes, instead of incorrectly.
Right.
Yes.
That's all.
Any other comments on either the minutes or the public availability comments? Is there anybody from the public would like to comment on either the minutes or the summary of public comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions?
Stay.
Minutes are adopted. The most important thing in my report is for me and the rest of us that we all need to speak louder than we did last week. It was we managed to, I think, find consensus among all representatives of the public that we should all speak louder. We received written comments that I don't think are in the members' packet, so I need to make sure we all receive them. There were two sets of comments from the New Jersey Farm Bureau, one dated September 23rd and one dated October 3rd. The comments from the Pequannock River Coalition dated October 3rd, and comments from the Reformed Bible Church of Hampton Plains. So I need to make sure that we all get copies of those, and we'll try to continue to make sure that any substantive comments that come into the council are seen by
Mr. Chairman. I believe that the Morris County Municipal Utilities Authority also submitted a document of commentary. Have we received that yet?
I hadn't recalled seeing it, but we can check.
Okay.
If so, we'll distribute it.
About three or four pages. Okay.
Janice?
Yeah.
Welcome. Janice Kovacs is here. Okay. Can you hear us, Janice?
Yes, I can.
Okay. That's the end of my comment, my report. Any members have other items they'd like to report this time?
I could just mention that there was a meeting in Warren County last Thursday sponsored by AMJEC and the Warren County Environmental Commission to educate elected officials and other municipal officials relative to the Highlands Act, and our deputy director attended, and I, due to illness, was not there, but I heard he did a great job of representing the council on that basis. I just want to acknowledge AMJEC, the Environmental Commission, and Tom, and thank you for doing that.
Executive Director's Report, Dante DiPiero?
Nothing today, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Committee reports, the Plan Development Committee met earlier today to discuss two contracts, which I guess are the next item on the agenda, so I'll mention them now. And the committee approved bringing both these contracts to the full council for consideration. One, a groundwater monitoring contract and the other support for the graphic design of the both draft and final regional master plan. Maybe, Tom, do you want to, or somebody want to summarize?
I think Patty's here
too. Well, we'll start with the septic one, the groundwater modeling one.
Oh, sure. Basically, this contract is for a groundwater modeling to build upon the work we have done with USGS on background nitrate. We have one bidder on the request for qualifications, very well respected firm who has done this throughout the region for assisting municipalities in septic density analysis. So it's recommended that the council approve this contract. We developed a resolution, which is in your packets.
It's, as folks will see from the resolution, it's time and materials not to exceed $25,000.
Do we have a motion to approve that contract?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move to approve it.
I'll second.
Any comments or questions from council members?
I'd like to just comment. We only have one bidder, right? One.
Correct.
One responder. That troubles me. It has been brought up before when this situation has occurred, and I know this is highly specialized work, very technical, and not a lot of folks out there. You can't grab somebody off the street and ask them to come in and do this. But it does trouble me that we are narrowly focusing our contracts to, in some cases, companies or firms or individuals who are the only responders to it. I wonder if the specifications were too narrowly drawn. I don't need a response right now. I just put that out there for consideration.
But just generally, if I could, these particular specifications, we don't think were particularly narrow. I think it was more to do with the fact that it's a time-specific thing. It's a time-specific requirement that we have because we need to move on this. In addition, the types of specialties, as you said, are fairly narrow. There are not a great number of firms who are available to do it, we did, I believe, Steve, could you just speak a little bit to how we put it out there, because I know we looked for, solicited firms to make sure that we were not casting the net too narrowly.
Yeah, and there are three firms that were identified that regularly provide the type of service within the region. Only one of those submitted the RFQ within the time that was specified.
But we alerted all three?
I'm not, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
DeMeco is a familiar name to everybody in New Jersey, right?
Yes.
There's no degree of propinquity here, or has somebody looked at this just to make sure that from an ethical standpoint, this is perfectly fine?
Tom, is any specific ethics beyond the norm? I mean, we don't have a particular conflict with them. I don't believe it's a conflict with the work they do with other firms. Do we look at anything further, Tom?
We haven't identified any ethical concerns in this. He has provided this to municipalities for the region.
Thank you.
So overall, we are aware of the issue. This is a situation where we did only have one, and we are mindful of that, and we will continue to be.
Any other comments from council members? Any comments from members of the public? Yes.
Oh, yes, I was wondering in terms of...
Steve, can you identify yourself?
Sure thing. Steve Shaw. I'm with the 100 and Warren County Council. I wanted to find out, there are three firms that are solicited. I was just wondering how it was determined who those three firms were who were regularly solicited. And then also just to find out procedurally, how do you solicit? Was this published like in a newspaper type circulation as well?
Yeah, we did a request for qualifications published on our website and did outreach that was available for submitting. We had a deadline for submission, and only that firm submitted.
Okay, and the two other firms were?
Mulhall, I don't know the third. I can get that for you.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
Just over there?
Yeah. My name is David Shope. I live in Long Valley. I've heard of DeMeco.
I read their name in the newspaper as a, quote, expert. Whenever a town wants to downzone, they hire D'Amico as an expert. That's the way that game is played. In Hunterdon County, back when the Smart Growth Initiative was going on, Hunterdon County hired the New Jersey Geological Survey to do their work. In Hunterdon, and I previously have submitted this information to you. If you've lost it, I'd be glad to give it to you again. It is vastly different in terms of nitrate dilution and consequently septic density and groundwater recharge than anything I've heard from you or DEP. And I'm sure it will be vastly different from anything you contract to do with D'Amico or Matt Mulhall, who's another one that towns hire when they want a downzone. That's the game they play. I think you ought to look further. I have not seen the resume, but if you find somebody that has represented the other side of the fence, we're more apt to get a decent work product from them. Thank you. Needless to say, I object to this process.
Anyone else who wanted to comment? Did you come up with the name of the third?
It's a Princeton Hydro. It was the third firm.
Okay. Any other comments from members? All those in favor of the resolution?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Okay. The graphic design support, Patty, the slide is there. This also is a resolution for up to $25,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have an RFQ that was out for graphic design support to provide the graphics and materials necessary for the draft release and the plan adoption. This will ensure that our visual materials and the look of the electronic, printed, and presentation materials are consistent and clear. And we got three bids back on this. We are recommending AKRF, an environmental and planning firm that has extensive graphics capabilities. They have worked with the council in the past and provided high-quality work on time and under budget. And we're recommending them for that reason, as well as the fact that they are the largest firm in terms of having sufficient depth. Given our tight time frames, we want to make sure that they can turn the materials around as quickly as possible, and we feel they're best suited for that. So we are recommending that we go ahead and contract with AKRF for these services through the next several months to bring us through plan presentation.
Through plan adoption.
Plan adoption, I'm sorry. Yeah.
And who were the other firms?
The other firms were Morello and Company of Butler, New Jersey, and Peter Mills, also in the area, town escaping me at the moment.
Not my legs.
Thank you. And they both are very small firms, which means you get the attention of the principals, and yet so small we had some concerns that they could be responsive to us, given our time frames.
Okay. Do we have a motion for the resolution?
I so move.
I'll second that.
Okay. Any comments or questions?
I'd like to ask Patty. Peter Mills does not show a total on the table.
He did not.
He did not show a total. Did anybody calculate it?
No, because he didn't estimate the hours associated with each project. He said he would come in within the 25, but it was in effect a somewhat incomplete proposal.
And I presume that one of the requirements in the proposal was that the project be completed in a timely fashion.
Yes.
Why were you concerned, apart from the size of the firms, that the other two might not be able to complete it in time? Because if they responded, they were obviously saying they could do it.
Absolutely, they were saying that. And I think some of it is just in that they don't have the experience specific to regional plan development. And it would just take more time of our staff's time to get them up to speed on that issue. And with fewer people, it just was a concern that they could meet those deadlines.
Other comments, Councilman?
Just Just have a question about the qualifications of the principal, AICP.
American.
Planner?
Yeah, they're planning.
Yes, planning.
Comments from members of public? Questions? All those in favor of the resolution?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions?
Abstained.
Resolution carries. The order in which we're going to discuss the 11th is the financial component, cash flow timetable first, and then critical habitat, and then transfer of development rights. Dante Ross, how are you going to start this?
I'll introduce the gentleman who's presenting. We have, members will remember that we have a financial component which is part of the regional master plan, and that has a couple of elements. You heard last time about the baseline economic indicators. Today, Ross McDonald and Anthony Cortese will present on the cash flow timetable, which is, as he will describe, a way that's required in the Act to determine what are the costs of implementing the Act and what are the revenues that are available. Ross.
Thank you, Dante. Good morning. I'm just here first to provide an update from the last time I was before the Council on baseline economic indicators. The primary request coming from the Council was one to further investigate the data from the SR1A sales reports that we received from taxation. Those have been aggregated and separated into the preservation and planning areas for 2000, 2003, 4, and 5. 2006 will be done when the equalized values are published by DCA. Mm-hmm. So Aaron Cardin, our GIS coordinator, has provided the report, and this will be going into the baseline reports for the public to review in the next week. So happy to report that we're able to provide that extra element to the baseline. In terms of the cash flow, it's really an extension of what we're trying to do in the baseline, which is establish a tracking and monitoring mechanism to reflect those revenues and costs, hard costs, associated with the implementation of the regional master plan. And really, it may serve us well to take a look at the financial component requirement in the Act, and it's very, very small and short. It says the Section 11A charges the council with developing the financial component together with a cash flow timetable. So this is the real direct mandate from the Act detailing the cost of implementing the regional master plan, including property tax stabilization, watershed moratorium offset aid, planning grants, state aid for local government units, capital requirements for the TDR program, payment in lieu of taxes, acquisitions 5 and 10 years after the date of enactment. And any anticipated extraordinary continuing costs, and then, of course, in each detail, those sources of revenues. So to do that, the approach was to develop kind of categories, and that leads us into the first policy recommendation, which isn't really the traditional policy recommendation, should we do a cash flow timetable? It's a direct mandate, but rather this is the approach we're looking at and finishing. So we're looking at four categories that would encompass all those things that I just read, which would be the planning grants program, land acquisition tracking program, state aid for local government units, and the Highlands property tax stabilization. We've created cash flow timetables for each of those, and they all have elements and components therein. So that's number one. The second policy recommendation is taking each of these four components separately, which number one would be create a planning grants program to track the planning assistance grants to municipalities and counties for conformance with the RMP, recognizing that there's going to be a level of work and responsibility and requirements for each municipality to review the cash flow, to review the regional master plan and implement that into their own municipal master plans. The legislature provided a series of grants for the realty transfer fees to assist those municipalities. So in working with the scientific and planning staffs, we've used a set of assumptions that would really outline what we feel we'll be needing in terms of planning grants over the next few years for full opt-in for the regional master plan. So we've created a series or a chart that is a timetable that's shown on page 4 that goes right into the appropriations, which is two primary sources for this for these purposes, the RMP compliance aid and the incentive planning aid. The grant awards were separated into three categories.
Russ, could you start by maybe explaining the three parts of the chart? So
yeah,
and follow up.
Sure, Dante. All timetables really are looking at three elements: the appropriations or the revenues, the awards or the costs, and then a net surplus deficit reflecting final balances.
And you've referenced full opt-in on the top. Could you explain what the chart showed?
Sure. And to consider how much money this could potentially cost the council, we used a series of assumptions that looked at 100% opt-in over the next few months. For example, we estimated that at a minimum it would cost roughly $100,000 per municipality or county for the revision of their master plans, the zoning ordinances, development regulations, and the general administrative costs. The remaining 36 planning area towns, which would meet the RMP conformance criteria, can choose to opt in during any time after the adoption of the regional master plan. And to ensure sufficient planning grants, we try to take a look at all 88 municipalities and 7 counties and assume that over the next 15 months after the adoption of the plan, 52 municipalities would come into conformance, and then after that that time period, 9 municipalities would opt in to this regional master plan over the next few years after that. And that's why the planning grant timetable goes out a few years to just really kind of, first of all, show some of these assumptions. Secondly, we'll be able to update these on an annual or regular basis to see if we're still on target or if these projections need to be reestablished. So that's the thought behind this. The appropriations, as said, are based on two elements from the appropriations as the regional master plan compliance aid, the incentive planning aid. The awards or the costs would be plan conformance grants, the TDR incentive grants, and then the special projects grants, which reflect the programs that are a result of our partnershiping with municipalities and planning issues as they arise. The agricultural grants that have been introduced over the last few weeks would be falling into that program. As you can see, we zeroed out the balance, and the overages over what those assumptions were for conformance were kind of put into the special project grants bucket, if you will, just to reflect, and that's really the most flexible area within these awards, and that they can be changed according to how this implementation process proceeds. When we look at the final tallies in a 5-year total, we're receiving $30 million for the appropriations, and to wit, we can make the assumption at this point that we do have enough monies to proceed with this full opt-in and work with all municipalities and counties at the levels that have been outlined from the planning staff. So that's the first timetable that we're looking at.
Russ, which number did these numbers match, which is more than coincidence, I assume. So
yeah.
Were you assuming these were the appropriations projected for 5 years and then making the awards meet that, or the other way around?
Sure. Well, on a traditional cash flow timetable zeroes out mostly, and in most of the cash flows tables that I've seen, what we did is we kind of worked backwards saying, okay, how much money do we think we'll need? And it actually came out that the original calculations showed about a $5 million surplus at the end of 5 years. And so based on that, then we kind of put in that $5 million over the next over the years in the special projects grant. So when we outlined $1.5 million for the special projects grants, we were then able to bump that up to $2.5 million to kind of compensate for that $5 million initial surplus. And so there is some flexibility here.
And if we don't realize those expenses, they're banked.
Yes. Yes, they're not lost. They remain available to us.
They're not lost, nor can they be used for other expenditures.
This, so. Correct. The Act specifies the only uses for that funding. So this at most, is our best estimate. It's required by the Act to estimate what towns would conform and on what kind of schedule, and then the monies are not lost. They just become reserves. But it was zeroed out, as Ross has indicated, as the overall prediction.
And if we're underestimating the rate or the timing of conformance, do we have any flexibility in getting an advance on next year's appropriations? I don't know, you can't answer that per se, but what would be the mechanism at that point? Are we going to have to tell towns to wait? Are we going to have to try and get additional appropriation from the legislature? What will happen?
Okay. Keep in mind that in the first 2 years of the grant program, we intentionally held money in reserve, so there is in excess of $7 million that is available in reserve, so that we were reasonably assured that there would be adequate money to meet all demands in the first year of implementation. So we don't anticipate that that's going to be a concern.
Okay.
So I think if it was, your two options are the options.
Right. When you don't have it, you need to seek it.
I thought I heard you say, Ross, that you're anticipating that we will be able to get $30 million. On what basis was that assumption made?
Well, that is based on the assumption that the current funding levels outlined in the Act would be consistent, and there would be no changes to the outlays over the next 5 years.
Because they are statutorily enacted?
That's correct. Right.
So that, another way of saying it is that's what the statute calls for currently.
So far, so good. Okay, so...
Ross,
yes.
A question for you. As I look at the Act... and you reflected in your paper, we're supposed to come up with this cash flow timetable for implementing the regional master plan. It does seem to me that there's at least an argument, maybe there's even a good argument, that implementing the regional master plan is a reference to the period in which people, in which municipalities have to bring their own standards into conformance with the regional master plan in the preservation area, and that one of the things this council ought to consider is whether or not to say to you and to the staff, look, we want you to really focus on that time period of implementation, which after all is also, I mean, looking out 10 years is very difficult, looking out 2 years is difficult, but it's a different order of difficulty. So I just wanted to say out loud, Mr. Chairman, it does seem to me that as the staff is looking for guidance, one of the questions is, do we think the Act calls for a 5-year or 10-year cash flow timetable? I know it does with respect to acquisitions, but that seems to be at least an outlier, which actually indicates that there is something else intended for whatever implementation means. And I, for one, would love to see us concentrate on implementation being that now 24-month cycle from today, or taking us out through the end of 2008, I think. And I'm not adverse to doing more than that, but it seems to me a question we ought to answer for the staff, and unless other people read the Act differently. Section 11 says, come up with a cash flow timetable for implementing the Act. So you have to ask the question, what does implementing mean? And then one of the clauses talks about acquisitions over a 5- and 10-year time period, but the fact that it spells it out seems to imply that the Act is talking about something else for implementation, something else than other than 5 or 10 years. So that might be a question you want to or I've done it for you, push back to the council and say, tell me what the staff ought to be doing.
Sure, and as you can imagine, reading and interpreting the act in this, with this mandate, really was, how do you capture the true costs of the implementation of the act? There's infrastructure considerations, there's build out, there's a host of hard and soft potential costs. So then, you know, kind of working backwards from that, well, then what if we were to look at those overall general soft costs in terms of infrastructure, and maybe that academic study would be captured through a fiscal impact analysis, which we're doing, and then concentrate on the economic profile and the cash flow, really reflecting those real administrative costs that we can bank on almost. But in terms of the cash flow statement, if they would have mentioned there should be a yearly or an annual cash flow statement that tracks this, that would have been one thing, but rather says there will be a cash flow timetable, and that suggested to me that every consideration would look out at a timetable. The planning grants and the acquisition certainly require a few years of consideration, as we're not going to be able to take care of this in 1 year and see how we did. But we did do that for the property tax stabilization timetable, as that this is still being put together by the Property Tax Stabilization Board, as well as the municipal financing, which is, as we know, or municipal aid, which has been frozen for the last few years. And so we've just kind of used those numbers and have not made any projections that that further try to project what the legislature will be doing in the next few years. But in the planning grant area and in the acquisition, we certainly at least have for acquisition the 5 and 10 year, or 3 and 8 years from the time of enactment. And planning grants, we would have to look at least through 2008, I believe, to try to capture that full opt-in scenario. But it's as the council wishes, we can stop there and just wait and see, and let the next 2 years really dictate those projections as those real costs kind of hit home and we're able to plug in better variables in these projection and approaches. So as you wish.
Do we have an opportunity to amend this timetable?
Absolutely, and that's the real benefit of setting this up and trying to figure out where we're going to be. We know there will be a level of right and wrong to a certain percent, but one of the issues that will be coming out through conformance and post-conformance will be an annual tracking and updating of all these cash flow timetables. So not only will we have the real costs, but those real costs will change those projections, assuming that they're not going to be right on.
I think the compliance process is going to take more than a couple of years. I really do. By the time you get 88 municipalities.
Yeah.
Some of whom it's not going to be on the top of their list.
And that's and it's really heartening to see that the balance carrying forward over the next 1 or 2 years, we do have that surplus, and whether or not we do it up front, we have enough money. If we take more time, then that'll be amortized over a longer period of time. So we're in good shape either way, and we'll record it however we're able to proceed.
If we did what Michael was suggesting, would that be the numbers would essentially be the same and we just lock this off somewhere in fiscal 09?
Yeah.
It wouldn't go out the next 2.5 years.
Yeah, it wouldn't.
The numbers for the first 2 years would be the same as what you have here?
The assumptions would stand at this point.
I'm not adverse to going out further, but one thing that I might do if I were in charge of the ink is have one color for 2007, 2008, maybe 2009, mm-hmm. and another color ink for 2010, and a footnote to make it crystal clear that we think the first chunk is what's called for by the Act, if we collectively thought that, and the rest of it is incremental stuff, and we all recognize that all of our projections are difficult, and those are particularly difficult. And conversely, we could say, look, the Act, for better or for worse, seems to talk about implementation, and that seems to be I don't disagree with Mimi, but the implementation of the regional master plan as regional master plan seems to be a 15-month process after we adopt it. I mean, that's generally what's called for in the preservation area. And so we might conclude that focusing on that, one, because it's doable, sort of, and two, because the other really isn't doable, it's so far out, is the right way to go. But I open the question for the council.
If we accept Councilman Salazar's recommendation, would the longer term ink be red and the shorter term be black? Is that
I'd probably pick something else, Jack. teal and mauve.
May I ask a question, or actually just throw an issue out there? Do we anticipate at some point, I mean, every municipal master plan is supposed to be reexamined every 6 years. And again, we don't have to answer this, but just throw it out there. Would we be anticipated continuing to fund master plan updates in perpetuity?
Right, and after the first, I'm sorry, Tom.
We're required to follow that same 6-year cycle.
Right, there's two things. We have to update our own master plan, which will in turn result in updates of okay. municipal plans. But the Act envisions long-term funding, so it creates a $12 million estimated appropriation that, based on the legislatures for 10 years and then $5 million thereafter. So I think the legislature anticipated a long-term funding okay. mechanism for updates.
And related to that, have we ever discussed the issue of once a municipality takes whatever actions to conform, is there an unconformance process? Are they locked in perpetuity?
There's actually a mechanism built into the statute that the funding they received is at risk should they reconsider.
In other words, after they conformed, the state could come and ask for the money back?
That's correct.
Interesting disincentive, too.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I had a question that I hadn't thought of until this second, actually, in this discussion, which is once a municipality conforms, decides to opt in and conforms to the master plan that we propose and adopt, and we change our master plan under that 6-year cycle scenario, will the conforming municipalities, you just indicated, be required to reconform their master plans? What if they choose not to do that? What if some of, in our changes, they see provisions that they were not so happy with and did not want to conform to? Does what council does suggest apply there? Or is there, we're changing the rules in the middle of
the game. Presumably it remains voluntary.
In the planning area?
Correct.
That's not how I read the Act, Dante, that once, if you make a decision in the planning area, to opt in, I don't think you have an ongoing option to opt back out for what it's worth. And in answer to Jack's question, preservation area or plan area, but certainly the preservation area, when we amend the master plan, seems to me the best argument is everybody needs to conform to it again.
I think that's clear in the preservation area. I would think in the planning area, a town, I mean, we might want to defrock a town in the planning area because they weren't making decisions consistent with what they said they were going to, and they might want to, they have a new election or whatever reason, change what they're doing and get out of this. And we would have to have provisions about how that works.
I would accept that. I think that's reasonable, that's common sense, because you can't expect somebody to continue to play the game necessarily.
We can address this in the draft, the conformance. It's not in there now specifically.
I mean, we haven't even adopted the first master plan.
That's right.
Thank you.
That's a good one.
But I think what's important about that is, you and I are thinking out loud here. Right. We're realizing this part of it is that as we serve as municipal officials, I'm thinking this could be a major issue about conformance. We're not going to be the only ones to think about this, and 88 municipalities are going to be thinking about this and probably having this laid out and clear. Well, it either will help or not, but whatever, at least it would be the right thing to do to spell it out.
So I think
how do we get a decision on this? You know, if the Act is not clear on the whole thing going forward, it,
I think as Tom said, I think we address it in the conformance document section.
Can we just decide how it's going to be, or do we have to go back to the legislature to get some kind of clarification?
Well, just like with every issue like this, when it arises as to what the act means, you've raised the issue, staff will take a look at it, determine what the act says, show it to you, show what our interpretation is, and then determine what to do from there. So I think Tom's suggestion is the right one, that is part of the conformance that you'll see in an upcoming work session. I think we just address this, and we will have more for you at that time.
Yeah, I didn't mean to lob a grenade into the process, which I've been going so smoothly, but...
Our meeting schedule for 2012 is in the packet.
Could I though chime in? I think there has been, from time to time, a view that we would amend the regional master plan and be in a position to do it, and maybe amend it more frequently than once every 6 years.
Correct.
And I think what you're talking about as a practical matter, and maybe even a legal matter, becomes very much alive. In other words, if we amend the regional master plan, say a year into things, we'll have 47 municipalities concerned about expense and whatever else they choose to be concerned about. And then if we do it again 18 months later, the same thing happens all over again. So I just want to say, as a practical matter, I don't really see us being able to amend the plan that frequently.
Well, of all the issues that have been raised, I think the cost, us helping towns with cost, is the easiest one for us to address, and that's why the legislature has ongoing funding from the realty transfer fees out way into the future. And I think the contemplated reason for that is because if the town does need to amend based on a change we've made or because of a new six-year cycle, they need additional funds to come through that to the towns. So I think the funding is less of a concern in terms of coming with an approach than is answering the other question about how we handle it with the terms of conformance. So we'll be back to you on that.
Okay. The next cash flow statement would deal with land acquisition tracking program. That by working with the council and staff, we'll proactively track and project potential costs and revenues associated with the acquisition goals resulting from the Highlands Land Use Capability Map. We've already run a few scenarios just to kind of start ground checking and setting up the assumptions for when the Land Use Capability Map reveals these acres, but we're looking at really three components of the cash flow timetable as well. One, what are the acres? Two, what are the costs per acre? And three, who's going to be paying for that? And we've begun to outline the revenue sources to date. We've been working with Garden State Preservation Trust Fund entities, Green Acres, and SADC. As we've collected their information over the last 15 years, we've been able to update their or adjust for inflation, their outlays over the last decade plus, and start coming up with general and initial projections on how much this land will cost. The beauty of the land use capability map process will then, once those acres are derived or submitted, we will have the capability through our GIS capabilities to review all the assessed and equalized values of those properties that are defined and then start gauging that against what we are projecting at this time with the available data. So we are quite confident that the projections on the cost per acre are going to be well-founded, and the revenue sources are really looking at what are the open space taxes now doing in county and the local municipal governments. Also donations, we also are looking at not-for-profits, federal grants, and the like. Federal government has spent $21 million over the last 10 years. So maybe looking at $1.5 million over the next 5 and 10 years of the enactment, from the enactment, is not is reasonable. And we also included in other sources of revenue entry just to try to capture those types of initiatives that the council and state entities are considering, such as water taxes and the like. So the key there, of course, is the GSPT reauthorization, and we heard the governor speak that once he receives these projections, they'll be able to use those for their own internal calculations. So that's really what we're looking at to do for land use capability. Once we knew that the economic analysis was going to be a lot of 11th hour calculations, we're going to get the we're going to get preservation acres and be able to sort out land use classes per parcel, per preservation and planning area. This is one of those 11th hour figures. Get the acres, plug it into our assumptions that over the next 5 and 10 years would fall into the preservation program, and then bring this back out to you. So right now we don't have the numbers, but we do have a framework set up to provide those numbers once the land use capability map feeds those acres to us. So.
Scott, there was supposed to be some money, I thought, from the federal government toward Highlands Preservation. I know there, unfortunately, it hasn't been appropriated, but it was earmarked.
Yes.
But I don't see any reference to it here.
Right. The federal grants for preservation, we're just looking at a projecting out based on the last 10 years. They've spent $21 million looking at what the federal government is now, where we could, that those numbers could be released, or those monies or funds could be released. But we haven't counted on it per se. We've just projected that over the next 3 and 8 year period, 5 or 10 from the date of enactment, we would receive an average of $1.5 million, which would be less than the Highlands Protection Fund, but in line with what they've been able to provide this region today. So it'll be captured in the cash flow.
There should be a reference somewhere in here that we understand that those funds are kind of out there.
Well, Ross, do we have any place where our recommendations in the legislative session include a recommendation that we seek funding at the maximum level from what was in the Highlands, the Federal Highlands Funding Act?
Yes, as part of the technical report that's being worked on, the series of recommendations or next steps or findings would be to actively develop an outreach in legislative coordinated fashion, both federal and state entities, to try to garner these monies that are required through this calculation. So I do expect that we'll be contacting state senators and representatives for these funds.
But you do say at the top of page 3 that it's estimated that an annual federal contribution will be roughly $2 million. So that's based on looking at the past, mm-hmm. and if Congress appropriates more money, maybe that number will be conservative.
Right.
Yes,
I think Ross was referring to the Highland Stewardship Act, which provides $10 million a year for 10 years, and which does not have it.
Right.
And that is primarily for land acquisition, as I recall, number one. And number two, we don't know what the allocation for the four states is yet. So we don't know what the formula is. It's all very questionable.
And there's other federal programs as well that have contributed to preservation efforts in this region. And Kimball Kaiser will be here in another work session to talk about all of those federal and state entities and not-for-profits as well. I'm just trying to aggregate them and come up with a reasonable projection.
And how would those, I can't recall, we discussed this, I know at land preservation, but how would the federal money be distributed? Through what programs?
Mm-hmm. They do federal money?
Yeah, if it comes through. Is it through the state? They were appropriate. And so would it be
probably
DEP?
Most likely DEP through existing funding, which is because, we don't have our own funding, so it would most likely go there. But has it been allocated yet, so we don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm. We just want to recognize that the federal government is involved. Hopefully they'll be a little more involved.
Good. So the good news in terms of revenues is that the current local and county open space monies, current donations, not-for-profit contributions, federal grants, all can equal up to $75 million a year without looking at the GSBT reauthorization. So there is money out there and can be used for these projection purposes. Again, on an annual basis, we'll be updating exactly what was spent and who's contributing, and then that'll just change the projections as we move on through this tool.
Just a caution. Once the municipalities know that we have sources of funding for acquisition, we may find that they start to back off. I mean, property taxes are a big issue, and that's where their funds all come from, the property tax. So we might find some real shifts in these funds.
And who opts in, who doesn't, and where are these priority lands going to be? And the land use capability map will change that per municipality. So as we...
If a town doesn't opt in, we will not try to preserve any land in that town?
No, I didn't mean to say that.
No, I'm just asking a question. Well, you're shaking your head, Dante.
That I don't believe that the staff is recommending that we would cut off acquisition for a particular landowner just because the town did not opt into the region.
So we could still acquire property even if they opt out.
Yeah, the value of those properties aren't going to change, and environmental values anyway. The next cash flow timetable is tracking state aid for local government units, and this encompasses the watershed moratorium offset aid, the payment in lieu of taxes from the Garden State Preservation Trust program, and a host of others that are outlined on the table, which is the block grant, municipal homeland security aid, and extraordinary aid. As everybody knows, the state aid formulas have been frozen, and the outlays have remained constant over the last several years. So when we went down with some projections to DCA and to our other folks that we're seeking guidance from, the question was kind of, nobody really knows where this is going to be headed. So to Mr. Salavera's point, this is a timetable that's very appropriate to just take a year-by-year look and see exactly when these are unfrozen, what are the changes, and then I think this is when the Next Steps program comes in, where we talk about asking for expanded or new programs to assist those state or to assist the municipalities. So that's kind of a static table now, and as you can see, that those numbers are constant. We just did add a 2% increase under the local and regional school budgets, as I was told that was to be expected. And so that's we're taking a kind of a wait and see approach there. And
we are chuckling because it's devoutly to be wished, 2% of
that. Yes, absolutely. Well, and so what these state aid to local governments really separate into three components: the municipal line, the state aid, or the local and regional school, and the county portion. And we're going to just separate those three and track those as they happen, and as we can influence them when they're ready. So that's the third timetable, which leads to the fourth and final timetable, which is encompassing the property tax stabilization portion of the act. And the Property Tax Stabilization Board has been meeting for over a year now, and I've been fortunate enough to act as their contact for the council, and been able to provide data and general administrative services. They've been having their meetings in this room to date. And speaking with John Eskelson, the chairman of the board, we've decided to take the same approach. Right now, there's not a lot of information that would really be useful in projecting these effects on the aggregate values of vacant land in the preservation or planning areas for those that opt in. Even last year, a total of $88,653 was provided to one of the seven counties for this, where the Property Tax Stabilization Board did request more information, more justification for that outlay. And this year, there seems to be even less activity. A lot of counties, a lot of towns are waiting to see what these final land use changes are going to be before hearing these appeals that may potentially affect their land values. By way of the SR1A sales data that we now are able to perform. And the parcelization really does allow us to run so many economic scenarios and queries. Vacant land in the preservation area in the entire Highlands region has gone off for, sold for 44% over the equalized value. In the planning area, they've sold for roughly 60% less than the equalized value in the planning area. So it's exact opposite of what you would possibly think right away, but it also shows that there's really no definitive statement that can be made based on this level of information, the county tax boards, and the sales data today. So we're kind of in a holding pattern with the property tax stabilization fund right now. As you can see, we're just tracking it for fiscal year 2006. FY 2007, it is anticipated now it'll be less than the $88,000, but subject to change once final land use changes come into play.
Okay, it's a process. My understanding is the Property Tax Stabilization Board made it pretty clear they don't want to hear from towns and municipalities until the plan's adopted. It wasn't just that the towns are waiting, but the board doesn't really want to entertain more.
Right, and certainly they didn't want to see a repeat of last year, which was kind of a blanket assumption without a lot of data to justify that. No question.
I have a question. When you refer to equalization tables, equalization is used to fairly. Are you talking about the same equalization tables that counties use to equitably distribute county tax rates? Okay, they are just by fact not representative of market values.
Right.
Is there any way? Which is why I would imagine you're seeing the trend that you saw.
But right, it's really two things. One, the SR1A, the market value really is maybe reflected in large transactions that show sales. So people are buying this over the last 12 months for a certain amount of money per acre. That's more of a market value. How does that reflect, or how does that square with what people are paying taxes on? And so the appeal process is I should have this reduced because I shouldn't be paying all of these taxes because the market is this. What we're able to do through the SR1A is just start to look at what those market effects are in relation to the equalized assessed values. But the equalized assessed values don't mean to suggest that this is the market value. It's just this is what people were paying taxes on, and this is how much compensation per acre or per parcel they received.
But it's really not a valid basis for what they're paying taxes on. It's almost an artifact that's being used to distribute taxes, but it's not related to market value. Though you can correct for it, you can use that to something. There's another I can't think of the word, but it would be used with every tax board looks at it. It's your relative. It's that ratio. That's the word I'm looking for. There's a ratio in there. If you would apply that ratio to equalized market value, equalized assessments, you might be able to get that closer in line, and it would be.
Yes, and that's what we've done. That the equalized assessed values have taken the ratio into account. And so the assessed value is, you're right, it's not getting to the market value, but it does get as close as we can in terms of what people are assessed at as what your property is worth and what you'll have to pay taxes on. And then we just take a look at that versus what's been sold in that area.
Let's continue this debate offline because I don't agree with what you're saying, but we don't need to spend time there.
Okay.
Which just is a fact, though, that the equalized value is a lot closer to market value than assessed value, and that's the purpose of it. And, you know, local tax assessors develop these ratios based on current activity within the real estate market, and then they apply that and give it to the county. So it's not absolutely accurate, but it's...
It was the best way to approach it. At this point, with all the data and aggregating and just trying to make it a quality document. We knew that we had those values to use. We know that we had the SR1A sales data, which, but we'll, I'm sure we'll have that conversation. So based on what we've just gone over, the pre-conformance strategy is really, as part of the conformance document, we'll be just asking and requesting towns to take a look at the approach, at the revenue line items and cost line items for their own review, comments, and recommendations. And there's no general requirement. We don't expect a lot of time and money to be spent on this, but we would ask them to just kind of ground truth the assumptions and the format that we've come up with today. And that goes for the conformance strategy as well, which is to request the municipalities and counties to use the cash flow timetable to track their own expenses. So we can give them these copies, and they can zero them out and put in their own. And if they submitted that back to us, then that would just allow for updated and more basis for projections as we provide that. Also,
yes. You said that we projected that it's $100,000 per municipality to bring themselves into conformance with the regional master plan. I'm just sitting here thinking, I don't quite know what the regional master plan is going to look like yet, although you know we're headed toward it as rapidly as we can. I don't mind that as a space holder. But I'm not sure. I don't want to sign off on that number myself today, so I'm raising it for my colleagues. If everybody likes that number, that's great. But it does seem to me that when we have a regional master plan, we will have a lot more information to rely on, and that number may be low or it may be high.
Mm-hmm. What we did in terms of trying to come up with that number is we spoke with a few planning groups at Frank Banish and Associates, and also reached out as I'm traveling to towns talking about the regional master plan and the like, asking them what are your perceived costs going to be. And some of the planners have also spoken to towns and have been doing this for towns, and that's kind of how we came up with that number. We did discuss a little bit about having some at the end of the day, from just that calculation, having a $5 million surplus that we put back into the special programs. So if it is more than that, we should be able to accommodate up to, you know, another almost $100,000.
My point, this section, like all the other sections we've discussed, will be in the draft plan as something for public comment that the council can choose to modify in the course of adopting the final plan based on.
Maybe putting it in boldface brackets would be a way to go right now, indicating that's a number that we're using, but it's subject to change.
Maybe we could use disappearing ink.
Mauve or teal.
Well, in fact, what we could do is do that for all assumptions that are based on similar type of approaches, which for your review.
That's not a good idea.
And so we say it's going to be this much per acre based on these set of assumptions. So I think we can change the technical report to reflect that.
It might be easier to put the few numbers about which we're certain in brackets.
Not a lot of brackets.
Right. Yeah.
But if you bracket the pages, it will look like
So as part of the conformance process, the next step would be just requiring municipalities to provide the complete list of preserved lands within their borders, just to, again, ground truth and make sure that our numbers are consistent with what's out there on the ground, and allow for one more look at values. The third would be to provide an educational and technical support in support of the financial component. And there's no secret that that's been a large portion of my job to date, which is talking with businesses and landowners about the ever-changing land use rights that they have and their options therein, including preservation programs. So through a series of outreach programs, handouts, and meetings to discuss issues with properties, that would be a recommendation that we'll continue to do those types of things. And the five-year resource protection and planning goal is again, is an extension of this, which is after 5 years, we're going to have much better projections and data and perspective on where this is headed financially. And that's when we can reintroduce how do we do it, and moving forward, the new projections and the justification for those. So that's when we'll square the reality from what we're doing now, which is the academic assessment and the assumption. The coordination and consistency considerations would be to, again, work with the entire council and staff to develop a technical guidance and process with the Garden State Preservation Trust to ensure adequate levels of funding. Not only that, but open space taxes and the like will be all part of that. The continuing to work with the Highlands Property Tax Stabilization Board, providing them the data, the analysis that they're looking at. They don't have a lot of staff or time to do that, and we're doing it here. So just continuing to work with these folks to make sure that their perspective is in line with the council's. And that generally is the cash flow time flow component of the financial component.
I just have two quick comments. One is the 2% figure that you cited for projected school costs. There aren't a lot of things that we can be certain of financially, but we can be certain that's an unrealistic number. And I would suggest that we come up with something higher than that that might be close to what is. Otherwise, it undermines. I mean, anybody who's familiar with what the dynamics are, school costs, know that that's unrealistic.
Yeah.
And you don't need to comment on it. I'm just throwing that out there, that if I were reading this, not sitting up here and reading it out there, I would laugh at that. And I don't think we want people laughing at our document.
I laughed at sitting up here.
Case in point, he was sitting up here and laughing. The other point is, I've lost my train of thought. When we look at cost per acre for preservation, what we're starting, something that occurred to me this week in hearing an anecdote about what was happening in Warren County is when we look to estimate what acquisition costs are going to be, to the extent we could factor it in along with the other 92 factors, is the fact that acquisition cost is going to vary based on whether there are grandfathered pre-existing approvals for the land, and it's going to be considerably higher if that's the case. And I don't know how we capture that in the analysis, but it's a factor that should be considered.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. For the critical habitat requirements.
Presenting are Steve Balzano and Aaron Lynham. Aaron's going to join us in a second. She's just here.
Just to be clear, when we're referring to T&E here, it's not thorough and efficient. Switching. That's endangered.
But it is critical.
Right.
Critical habitat, just by way of introduction, is part of the resource assessment, ecosystem management element of the plan. That seeks to direct and inform protection needs for threatened and endangered species of plants and animals, including by reference species that are considered rare within the region. For purposes of clarification, the distinction between critical habitat and significant natural areas, where plants inform both. Significant natural areas are sites or areas that are known to have regional significance because of its unique qualities. They are not intended to capture all habitats that may be necessary to provide for the survival of species of concern within the region in accordance with the requirements of the Act for identification and protection of critical natural resources of the region. So therefore, critical habitat is a broader category that looks at the whole region, not just individual sites. Critical habitat is, again, one of the features, or another feature that defines both development of the land use capability map in terms of identifying natural resources that are regionally significant and in need of a heightened level of protection through inclusion and specific zones or are otherwise free of constraints and therefore appropriate to accommodate appropriate levels of development and growth, or but as well a resource concern that is appropriate for consideration at the site plan review level. So like many of the resource issues that we've discussed, it has components that inform the map and then components or standards that inform subsequent site plan review. Speaking to the policy paper, page one, item number one, is the acknowledgement that critical habitat will be an important component of the regional master plan, will inform the land use capability map, and will specifically include the protection needs for threatened and endangered species as well as rare species. Rare are defined by reference to include those species due to their distribution and current population status are designated as such through a program called Natural Heritage Program, which is a program that's administered through the DEP that collects, compiles, and analyzes information on the status and trends of species and assigns a heritage rank known as S1, S2, or S3 based upon the number of occurrences, the size of the population, and the relative vulnerability of those populations to losses due to land development activities. Additionally, is the introduction by reference to what's known as the landscape project. DEP, Endangered and Non-Game Species Program, has been very supportive of the Highlands Council in developing a next-generation model that identifies habitat as suitable for animal species of concern. Animals include birds, mammals, invertebrates, including mussels, which is a very important species of concern because of its value as water quality indicators. Odonates, which are dragonflies and damselflies, which are also very important indicators of water quality because of the larval stages are aquatic and very sensitive to water quality characteristics, and butterflies, which are terrestrial in nature but designated as endangered or rare and as such deserving of an equivalent level of protection. The landscape project was developed and is used to inform a lot of the information on identification of habitat throughout for inclusion in the regional master plan. There are attachments included at the end of the policy paper. There's two appendices, those listing the animal species that are currently proposed for as rare, threatened, or endangered status. There are 72 species of animals, including invertebrates, within the Highlands region that the plan would look to protect and manage. The Appendix B is a list of plant species, including rare, threatened, and endangered plant species, of which there are currently 137. We're coordinating with the Department of Environmental Protection to ensure that that list is as current as possible. And it may need to be revised as we move forward, but that's the current state of understanding.
Steve, may I interrupt you just briefly?
At any time.
The list that you have provided us was provided by the DEP. We are not creating new species to add to this list.
Absolutely not. It is based upon existing
We are not doing field studies to go out and identify unidentified species.
Correct.
This is all available information about which we believe relative to the continued viability of the Highlands region.
Correct. The endangered, rare, threatened, and endangered species provide important indicators of habitat quality. And I'm going to use the analogy the canary in the coal mine, is that species diversity and maintenance of species diversity is extraordinarily important indicator of environmental health. The species that are supported by the same environment for which us humans derive the same benefits, water, clean air, food and housing, are dependent upon those same resources. So as using species, particularly rare, threatened, endangered species, which are those that are more likely to be early indicators of environmental or degradation, by using them as indicators of environmental health, we are more able to ensure that environmental processes are maintained, and those processes provide benefit to not only wildlife populations, but also human populations. Item number three, the introduction of the importance of protecting a particular habitat type known as vernal pools. Vernal pools are those habitats, they're what's called ephemeral water bodies, which means they dry out seasonally. They are essential to maintaining amphibian populations. In the absence of vernal pools, most amphibian populations are currently and will continue to be decimated. Amphibians, again, are important environmental health indicator species. They provide important indications of the overall quality of the habitat. They are very susceptible to changes in water quality. So as water quality changes, amphibians are one of the groups of species that show early indications of that environmental degradation, which can have human health implications.
Steve, how are you going to identify these vernal pools? I mean, they really only show up at certain times of the year. I know that we had a property in town, we were going to build a park on it, and we didn't know there were any environmental problems on it until suddenly, because we had never seen them. And then all of a sudden, it showed up in the spring. There were all these pools on it, so it's hard to identify them.
A lot of the plan is built on what is known to occur. In many cases, that known information can be derived from historic records or surveys that have been done either by the state or other interested parties that has been verified through some level of quality assurance. A lot of information for particularly vernal pools you can remote sense, which means you can use aerials and satellite imagery to get a fairly good indication at a gross level, regional scale, of where those resources exist. However, in both cases, they are never 100% complete. So there is always the necessity, and there are policies that are included, to ensure that there is a level of consideration during site plan review to address what we don't know. So there are a variety of data sources and methods to compile information that we know. It is never 100%. So there may be situations where...
How would you find out if it's the off-season when they're not wet?
Yeah, it there are
borings, test borings,
identification of a vernal habitat is relatively easy regardless of the time of year, with the exception of maybe when there's snow cover on the ground. What is more difficult is whether or not it constitutes habitat in the context of supporting a species of concern, what's called an obligate vernal species. That typically can only be done during the breeding season, but in the normal course of events, it's relatively easy to identify a vernal habitat because it holds water, it has unique characteristics. A lot of times that can be observed from an aerial photograph or easily observed in the field. Once that's identified, should there be justification to do additional analysis? For example, if property owner wants to refute that it is indeed a vernal habitat, then there are some things that can only be done during the breeding season, and therefore the applicant, let's take for example during site plan review, that doesn't want to adhere to protection needs, it wants to refute the fact of whether or not it is a vernal habitat, would have to abide by standards that would require seasonal documentation during the breeding season
for a particular species. I have a question, Steve, related to the vernal pools. Are we looking at the New Jersey DEP inventory? You know, they do an identification program. Bless you. As a matter of fact, I'm a volunteer for the New Jersey Herp Atlas for the last 5 years, and we were trying to about how to go out and identify vernal pools, and I know there is an active program ongoing at DEP. However, because regulations that were proposed by the DEP were not adopted to protect vernal pools, I think the program kind of slowed down. Do we have access to the inventory of what actually has been identified so far, and yes, are we using that in identifying it on our map?
Yes, we're using two primary sources of information. One is that information compiled by the DEP. The other is information that was compiled by CRISA at Rutgers. They're compatible programs, but we are coordinating with the department so that those will be one and the same over time.
In this section, number three, you have some protective buffers listed here, and you have some references at the end of the rationale. Do those references cover both the 1,000-foot buffer and the 300-foot buffer?
The references are specific. In order to protect vernal pools, there is a recommendation, and why we're dealing with them separately, for a 1,000-foot protection area buffer. The 1,000-foot is derived, and the references support that 1,000 feet specifically, derived based upon what the needs, what the home range needs of amphibian species are. Amphibians are semi-aquatic. They spend part of the time, particularly in vernal pools, which dry out, in adjacent terrestrial habitat. Maintenance of that habitat is necessary to maintain the population. The 1,000-foot is necessary when that vernal habitat is isolated from any other aquatic feature. So what the staff is recommending is that where that vernal habitat is contained within a riparian quarter, there is a linear feature then that can provide the habitat needs of the species, and the reduction in protection needs are then justified given that the protection of riparian areas and other elements of the plant.
Well, then this 300-foot and this 1,000-foot is included here, but not under the riparian area, Highlands Open Waters element?
Correct. That vernal pools, very similar to Highlands Open Water Protection buffers, vernal pools would be a separate resource layer that any applicant would have to address. We provide information on where we know they occur, where the protection areas are. If you fall within that protection area, you must address the standards related to that resource.
I would just suggest here that every place you have 300-foot and 1,000-foot, we insert minimum for the same reason that we discussed when we were discussing the riparian area. And then later on, where you have the standards, I would suggest a bullet to cover that if a certain species is found that needs to have an expanded area of buffer, that we leave ourselves the flexibility to include that.
There has been some comments with consistency of the vernal pool habitat buffer and the recommendation specifically by the Department of Environmental Protection that we adopt the standard 1,000-foot width around all vernal habitat. That is a comment that came in that is still out there.
I'm just suggesting that it not be a maximum, that it be a minimum, and that we leave ourselves flexibility should a species be found that needs more.
How common do you think isolated vernal pools are?
They're, by definition, very common.
We just don't know.
And are they usually mapped as freshwater wetlands or not?
They would be treated as a highlands open water because they are, for intents and purposes, meet that definition as well. But they are typically not mapped as such because they are very small. Some of these are, 50 feet in diameter. They are generally very small, isolated depressions.
But you're not always near any other bodies of water.
They do not need to be.
The ones that I was referring to are very high up in a totally wooded area.
Yeah, and the most valuable ones are those that are in the middle of the woods.
Yeah, built that ball field, huh?
Yeah.
Steve, when do we anticipate knowing from you where these critical habitat areas might be?
We have them defined already. Not ready to present to you today, but...
But you have a map that's in progress and...
Yes, yes. Okay. We already have them.
My other comment is I just pulled up the stuff from September 11th, the significant natural area stuff, and I'd sure ask you to give serious consideration to melding the two of these things. I'm at least sitting here not certain exactly how they differ and certain that they overlap substantially.
Yes.
So for what it's worth, my suggestion would be go back to meld the two or make clear why we need two instead of one.
Yeah, and I would offer that the clarification of the definition of what constitutes a significant natural area will help reinforce why they are separate. Because, for example, a geologic feature would be...
You don't need to do it now.
Okay. Yes, I am.
We can talk about that in the context of the map.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple comments. One is just on Michael's point. I guess the idea is that when the maps in particular are melded, that and there are similar or analogous protection standards that are being proposed for different resource areas, that when they occur, they'll be additive, so to speak.
Yes.
So that the most protective standard will apply. Kind of goes to Tracy's point a little bit about what that is. So that's my first point. The second point is generally on the use of the landscape map. I think it's acknowledged that's also a living document, and that part of it is based on identification of sightings. And so part of this process will be to update that, and to the extent that we do discover new species through the inventory process or independently or as endangered and non-game moves forward in their work, that we'll update that and reflect that in the standards and the protection. And then I know when the DEP first integrated that map into the coastal management program, into the Freshwater Wetlands Act regulations, they were clear that to legally establish that the map stood as a standard, that there was that there had to be a presumption of validity to it, and that the regulatory process put the burden on the applicant to disprove that the mapping is not correct. So I would urge that put that standard in. And then lastly, I'm still a little confused on where the sort of conservation equivalency comes in terms of if a 1,000-foot buffer is necessary to protect isolated vernal wetlands, then if you have a vernal wetland that's on the edge of the riparian area, which we define as it could be defined solely on hydric soils, why will we not then have 1,000 feet from the edge of that pond or pool that exists outside of that defined area? Or how are those equivalent, I guess, is my question.
Based upon comments we received, we may come back and revise that and include the full 1,000. When we looked at the distribution of vernal habitat within the riparian area, what we found is that generally they were contained within that linear corridor, so that a lesser protection need was justified. The basis of the protection buffer is movement patterns of animals, and animals never move at exact radii in all directions, so they use the landscape to meet their requirements. If there's sufficient land that's available, such as through a linear corridor, to meet those life requirements of the species, then you don't need a fixed circular buffer. The importance then is maintaining the connection between that riparian area and the vernal habitat, so that movement or the contiguous habitat is not interrupted. But areas that are outside that linear feature, in the case of connection with the riparian, are less important to sustaining that population. So that's really, really where it came from.
I guess I think you need to really get some thought as to whether those are equivalent. I guess my experience long, long ago was with eastern spathed toads, and I don't want to see a situation where a road is put just on the edge of the riparian area. The toads breed, they all head out from the pond like this, and 3/4 of them end up on a road because the road's only 325 feet away from the edge of the Lepian corridor. So I mean, just if 1,000 foot is the protection measure that's necessary, I certainly should find somebody to integrate that into.
So noted. Item number four, in order to inform the land use capability map, one of the challenges are to define that habitat that is regionally significant and most important to protect. There is a lot of habitat. There is wide distribution of habitat. It is not practical to include all habitat that may be suitable for one or more species in the protection zone. So we're recommending creating a critical habitat resource area. This is very similar, if you recall, to the forest resource area. It takes goes through a deliberate process of selecting the best of the best habitat, and that best of the best is based upon the distribution characteristics of suitable habitat. So we try to identify that land that includes the most prevalent, contiguous extent of habitat that is deemed important to protection of the species. In order to do that, we worked with the Department of Endangered and Non-Game Species Program and further classified species based upon how dependent they are on the highlands region for their survival. For example, bald eagle is a species that occurs within the highlands region. It is not, its population survival within the state is not largely dependent upon the highlands region as much as it is other areas of the state. By comparison, a species such as northern goshawk is a species that is largely exclusively almost dependent upon the highlands region for its survival in the state. So we distinguish between those different type classes of species through what's called as a conservation vulnerability index. That essentially says that identifies those species whose vulnerability vulnerability is much greater as a result of alterations of land use changes within the region than other species, and use those to inform definition of a critical habitat resource area, which is the most valuable, in our opinion, habitat that exists within the region.
Is that sort of nomenclature thing? If I understand this, we're going to have something that's called a critical habitat, and then we're going to call it a potentially of low significance. That just doesn't strike me as the right way to go. Either it's critical habitat or it's not. So maybe you could think through some
sure.
other names.
And I think since these areas are not necessarily contiguous, that there would be plural critical habitat, whatever the term is. Resource areas, would that not be more accurate? We're not going to have one point on the map that's going to say this is the critical area or this is the resource area. We're going to have more than one.
Correct.
Is that multiple?
Yes.
And I mention that because it comes up later in this document. I just want to be clear that there will be areas.
Yes. Okay. It's important to note that there will be critical habitat outside of the critical habitat resource area. That is the bulk of it.
But there will be. Not as significant, not as critical as the critical.
Well, it's.
I just reiterate. I think that through very seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to create critical habitat and then tell us you don't want to protect it for a series of reasons.
Right.
Let's take it through.
Yeah. And good point. Yeah. But it's an important concept in that, just like open water protection, you have streams that drain everywhere within the highlands region. Part of developing the land use capability map is distinguishing, and it's a difficult thing to do, distinguishing those streams that represent a regionally significant resource from those streams that the council still wants to protect, but does not rise to the occasion of regionally significant. The importance of regionally significant is that it informs definition or delineation of zones of the map. We're trying to separate the lands within the Highlands region into those that represent regionally significant resources for which there needs to be stringent controls on land uses to maintain those values from those that are less constrained.
Well, I may make a suggestion to achieve that goal, why don't we call them not critical habitat resource area, but highlands?
Yeah, actually, that was
a resource area, right. And then do the breakdown that you subsequently get done at page 5. Either critically significant, significant, or most.
We understand how we can do it.
Item number 5.
Steve said he had this one.
Tim had something, and then I'll go.
I mean, the other thing, just in terms of the nomenclature, you don't use the term regionally significant in evaluating the three classes, so that might be another suggestion. But it reminds me of the Gary Larson cartoon about the great white shark and the not so great white shark.
I was thinking about olive sizes. Jumbo and colossal.
The serious question is, so to the extent this is tied to the vulnerability index, which is a statewide assessment, right?
No, it's a Highlands region.
Is it only regional?
Yes.
Okay. Because I mean, it seems that to the extent that there are less protection of critical habitat in much of the state outside of this region, the pines, then that relative importance will shift, right, as the state moves towards build-out. Will we reflect that? Will the islands become increasingly important as a bastion of biodiversity?
Yes.
And will that be significant enough to shift the way we would classify the relative protection of those areas within the region?
No. Just by the nature of the species, for example, bald eagle, which is predominantly a coastal species, is more of an anomaly specific to reservoirs within the region, so that will never change. The species will still have a largely or more greater dependency in terms of overall survival on other areas of the state than they will on the Highlands region. Even should the decline of the species occur in other regions of the state, the Highlands is not such that it would maintain that population in perpetuity.
I have a problem with this section because I don't quite understand what it means by saying that the area includes contiguous areas of important habitat for wildlife based on a concentration of habitat. Now, I mean, I know what those words mean, but then what is a concentration? In the forest, in the farmland, there was a number of acres that associated with this. So I think that's one problem, how we define that. I didn't see that later in the paper. But also related to that, I don't know why we are refining it so much as this. Why don't we just have those areas that are critical habitat? Why do we have to have these gradations of protection? They're all important because they, you know, whether or not it's highlands depend, you know, species, concentration of species in the highlands or not. If they're critical, if the habitat is critical for that species, why don't we just have one level of, you know, high level of protection?
And there is provisions when you're outside of the highlands habitat resource area to allow for review and protection as necessary for the individual species.
But it's limited because you have the critical habitat then identified, and then there's only a certain amount of buffering or area that's associated to define what that critical habitat is. It seems like the area gives you the opportunity to expand that. So, as you said earlier, you know, an animal will use a whole landscape. So it really, in many instances, when we get down to the highest level of integrity of habitats in the highlands, they may be contiguous, and they may, you know, animals and different species may travel across those areas. And I don't see why we're limiting ourselves so much in terms of the levels of protection that we give to an area like that.
And the distribution of habitat is so largely fragmented and diffused throughout the region that it doesn't lend itself to informing the land use capability map. So, the process we used, and we're still refining that, is the minimum, what constitutes concentration of habitat is the minimum land area that accounts for at least 90% of the extent of suitable habitat. So it is the least amount of land that captures 90% of habitat that is deemed to be suitable for a species of concern.
Can you just give us an example, put some numbers on that? Is there a way to do that?
Yeah, I wish we would have the...
How about the bald eagle?
Plus or minus 1%.
In terms of overall, well, the if you were to include all habitat that is suitable for any species of concern throughout the entire Highlands region, you're probably accounting for 75-80% of the region in its entirety. By selecting the area that consists of the vast majority of habitat within the smallest geographic area, the 90th percentile, you probably reduce that order of magnitude to about 50 to 55% of the region. So what happens is, as sprawl continues to advance, landscapes are fragmented, just like forests, the habitat, the remaining habitat patches become smaller and smaller and more diffuse around the edges, the interface between the rural portion of the region and the more urbanizing portions of the region. So that 10% of total habitat area is spread along a much greater area, 20 or 30% of the region, where 90% of the habitat that's concentrated within 50% of the land area. So that by taking or reducing that, it gives a much more defined area that represents regionally significant resources for purposes of informing the map to the extent that it's useful. If we were to capture 80 or 90% of the region and then inform the regional protection zone of the map based upon that 80 or 90%, we would introduce a lot of conflict that would diminish the value of the map.
But also address at the local level. I mean, at the site plan level.
Yeah, and there's still protection needs, just like open water, that just because it's not in the zone doesn't mean there isn't requirements or standards for review and for minimizing impacts to habitat that's outside the zone.
Right, the analogy is to the discussion we had about soils, right, that you said, or slopes, I'm sorry, slopes. And you got to 10%, the geography in which they occurred was so diffused without that.
Yeah.
I would go back to, and maybe your point you just touched on, which is later in the document, about whether or not we are, by defining this core, I don't want to see us pulling back the lines, in essence, and losing that opportunity, one, to protect what does remain, as well as to keep open the options to restore and recreate those connections, that integrity to that habitat, that quality. So if the mechanisms that you're talking about, aside from the map and the delineation of classifications within the map, will achieve that goal, then just please touch on it as you get to it.
Yes.
That's the test in my mind. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to associate myself with both of those comments. I'm not quite sure why we've got the fine gradations even after I listen to this. And in respect to what Tim said, I guess I'd like us to see as a council, if you're doing this at 90%, I'd like to see your 90% map, but I'd like to see your 95% map and your 100% map, and have us determine as a council to reject. And if somebody wants to see 80%, that's fine with me as well. But I also look at section 36, which you quoted to us, in terms of the NJDEP permitting process, and it sure seems to me, well, I shouldn't put it that way, A quick look at this would seem to indicate that the drive of the legislation would be not to the 90% or 80% level, but be to the 100% level.
Well, I think it does say critical habitat. It doesn't just say habitat. So there's got to be some meaning of what's critical as opposed to...
Sure, John, but let me read it. It will not jeopardize the continued existence of species listed, and so on and so on and so on, and will not result in the likelihood of the destruction or adverse modification of habitat for any rare, threatened, or endangered species of animal or plant. Now, there may be a whole series of words of art in there that I'm not familiar with, but on its face, it would seem to say, and I didn't know about this 100%, but I'm glad Steve alerted us to the 90% question, but it would seem to take into account the 100% area on its face. I can be told that's just flat wrong because that's not how people understand it or the courts have interpreted it differently. But on its face, it looks that way.
Yeah. And just for point of clarification, policy number one and two speaks to all habitats. All habitat, 100%. Policy item number four speaks to that subset of that habitat that informs the land use capability map. If you go forward in the policy document, policy item number 12 speaks to design standards that pertain to all habitat. So just because habitat does not occur or may not occur within only one zone, there is still the protection standards to ensure that 100% of that habitat is considered during site plan review. The purpose is to take the subset that represents the most important or the greatest constraint on land use and to call that out in a zone so that you don't get into a situation where you get to a site plan review that represents a higher likelihood of conflict with the resource protection goals of the plan.
Well, I must say, I just don't understand any of that.
But even if I understand what Steve said, even there, we have different levels of protection. Yet, if I read ahead, it appears that we're applying one uniform level of protection to what we're protecting, the island's resource habitat zone or area, regardless of the significance, whether it's high or significant or low significant. Or shall I wait until we get to point 12?
Yeah,
because it is confusing to me, too. Maybe as you explain it, if you would explain what paragraph applies to the entire area of Highlands Resource Habitat, and within that, whether that paragraph applies in different levels, whether it's high significance or it's high critical.
There is no high, moderate, or low critical habitat. There are species ranks based upon whether the species survival is critically or not critically dependent upon the Highlands region. So when we talk about the Highlands rank of the ninth item number four, critical, significant, or low significant, that is the degree to which that species survival relies on the habitat in the Highlands region. There are only two distinctions of critical habitat in the region. One is all habitat that is suitable based upon the known distribution of a species of concern to provide habitat for that species. The second is the resource area, or that subset that represents the most important area of the Highlands region to provide for habitat for species of concern. The resource area is a subset only to help inform the map and to separate those lands that are most constrained from those lands that are less constrained. The entire extent of critical habitat, or all habitat, that may support one or more species of concern, is reviewed, is not lost. It is reviewed, it is carried as a resource information that it can be reviewed on the site plan review. So if you have a habitat, which is very possible, that extends within a regional development zone, that doesn't mean that that loss of that habitat value is permitted. Standards would apply that would require for minimization or mitigation of those losses before any development application would be approved. The purpose is to try to, with all resource information, is separate out the best from the best. The area of land that is least suitable for development, most important to protect the character and qualities of the Highlands region, and inform that through the zone definition. But all land has levels of constraint associated with it. All development has ecological consequences associated with it. What we're trying to do through the zones and the map is minimize that consequence of future development activity, not eliminate it. It is not possible to eliminate.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a suggestion then, based on what you're saying. I mean, I assumed, I think Jack brings up a good point. How does this then, I was assuming this was translating into levels of protection. And the way I assumed that was going to be applied is through these plans that are required.
Yes.
And then the technical guidelines that would be developed for these plans would somehow use this information. But if that is not the case, why don't we just remove this whole section? I don't see really the purpose for it. If it's really not, I know what you're saying, but if
different levels of significance.
Yeah, these different levels of significance. And also, I have a question on that. Did DEP do this for us for the Highlands? Like, they don't use this other places in the state then? Or is this something they did for us?
Yes.
Okay, so this is not an established thing they use across the state anyway.
No.
I would suggest we take that whole section out then.
That section is relevant in terms of it's a subset of all species habitat. We do not, for purposes of defining the resource area, weigh a bald eagle as heavily as we do a northern goshawk. And the reason for that is we're trying to find an area that represents the most regionally significant habitat in the Highlands region based upon its habitat for rare and threatened species. That a habitat that is absolutely essential for the continued survival of a species within the state of New Jersey is, in my opinion, and staff's recommendation, much more significant regionally and locally than a habitat that is important to a species' survival but not essential. And
how
that's
does
what
it
that
translate?
Gets
at. Correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. How do these levels of protection translate on the ground?
The levels of protection that there is it is a reduction of conflict. So where there is the highest probability of conflict between resource protection and development activities, institute the highest level of protection standard, so the zone.
Mr. Chairman, as I told you before, I have to dismiss myself. I apologize. I'm very sorry that Kurt isn't here because I'm leaving to slaughter pigs, and I wanted to say goodbye one farmer to another. Last word for me, at any rate, on this. I don't see the distinction in the Act. In fact, I see words that would seem to drive the other direction between endangered species that are very important and endangered species. And I understand the distinction that Steve is making that are less important. And I would suggest we don't head in that direction in terms of distinguishing. But my last word.
Michael has dropped the flag, so I'm going to pick it up. And to Tracy's point, if I may, there could be species in an area that are critically significant, deemed so, and low significance within the same area.
Correct.
We would have to identify both of those species, and we would then have to apply the higher standard.
Correct.
Right. So why not just have a standard that applies to the highest level within an area where we know that species?
That's what we did.
That's good.
That's exactly what we did. So what we did is, and it's a very limited, it's about 10% of the total area that drops out because it only provides habitat for a species that is not dependent upon the region.
Well, I think that this language confuses.
Yeah, so we can work to clarify the language.
No, maybe using the word essential, you know, when he went through one of the explanations and said essential, that helped me understand the difference between important and essential.
Tim suggested before regionally significant resource area, which is effectively what this is.
Well, but isn't it? I mean, the critical habitat seems like the key phrase. It's not evaluating which species is more critical than another, but what habitat is critical for each of the species.
For different species.
For different species. And what you're saying, but I don't think here in writing, is two things. One, you're saying that it's basically 90% of the habitat in the Highlands region is going to be, in your recommendation, that's what would be considered critical. for most species, but for some species it wouldn't be that because the highlands is a critical habitat for the species. Is that right?
All species are equal, some are more equal.
It takes a subset of all habitat for that habitat that is necessary to maintain the survival of species that are dependent upon the region. Then looks at the distribution of that habitat and selects that land area that accounts for 90% of that habitat within as small a land area as possible.
And that's not really stated here at all.
And that's what we provide clarification on. But the implication of not of trying to capture 100% is that critical habitat doesn't inform the land use capability map because it is too diffuse. So it is not possible to capture 100% of critical habitat in the land use capability map. You could do that through site plan review and just put it out there as a resource constraint, but it will not define the zone.
Do you capture the 90%?
Yes.
Okay. Right, that's the bottom line issue for me, is that through those mechanisms that you're using to describe and characterize the habitat, and then to control or manage the activities which might affect that critical habitat, do you afford them the same level of protection, whether they are mapped or whether they fall into the 10% that doesn't get mapped?
Yes, same.
So we're not, there are no lesser animals in our farm here, so.
But there are lesser habitats.
But I think it sounds to me like Steve says, the science staff is being a science staff, and they're describing, and perhaps they're describing to a point that is has less value in terms of the management. They're describing it, and they're creating these gradations, but then in the end, they're treating it all comparably.
Yes.
Okay. So too much information may not be helping us at this point.
Right. I think we should rework this section, because then that's why I asked my question. How does this play out on the ground in terms of the levels of protection that are afforded?
If
there's less protection given based on these three categories, less given to some than others, then I'm not in favor of it. I think we should assume the highest standard for all of them. And then if the way this plays out, because I don't see it later in the document, is if you could answer that when we get there. I don't expect you to answer that now, but how does this get applied?
Right.
Through the plans, through your site plan, how does it actually get applied?
Through site plan, where if you're in a growth area and have habitat, through site plan review. That's the smart design standard.
So it's not through the map, it's through your site plan review.
Correct. Yeah, this section, policy 4, only speaks to that subset that informs the land use capability map, not all protection requirements.
Okay.
I guess what Steve's saying, this is not a simple plan.
No, you got to come to the map room one day.
But really, we never expected it would be simple, but it is very complex. And it's difficult sometimes to grasp the complexity. Mm-hmm.
But are you saying that conceivably, a site in a regional growth area could be habitat to bald eagles, and the policy of the plan would be to minimize the impact to that habitat, but it wouldn't prohibit development and have a buffer because the highlands is not critical habitat for bald eagles.
Unless there were a spotted salamander.
Right. Exactly. Is that what you're saying?
That the development could only occur if it can occur without adversely affecting the species. So if there was a bald eagle in a development zone, the only development that would be permitted is development that is compatible with maintaining that bald eagle. It does not acknowledge that bald eagle is not important and not deserving of protection.
But that doesn't answer John's question.
So even if the highlands is not critical to the survival of that species,
it's still regulated as critical habitat.
As at the highest level?
Comparable to all species, yes. The okay. Policy number one. let's just, okay. Policy number one defines critical habitat as all species that are threatened, endangered, or considered or classified as rare. That includes both plants and animals. Policy number two uses or acknowledges the NJDEP's landscape project as a method of defining where animal habitat is throughout the region. Policy number three acknowledges the importance of vernal pools as another element or source of information on critical habitat. Policy number four says, using all that information as a subset of what constitutes the most regionally significant habitat will be a resource area that captures the majority of contiguous habitat of all those for those species that are most conservation concerned. So four only reduces the number of species for purposes of defining the most important area. But all species are captured under item number one or two. Does that?
I think that's all clear, but still, I don't know the answer to the question, and maybe
so what do we do with the bald eagle? I want to get back to it.
A bald eagle would still constitute an endangered species within the region. It would be, regardless of what zone, if it was in the protection zone, it is protected by default because all uses are limited within the protection zone. If it occurs within a development zone, then any site plan, any application that falls within that habitat would have to be reviewed against its impact to that species of concern.
Some kind of linear development, some kind of driveway.
Yeah, or
discussed with the site plan.
Yeah, well, the difference is the difference in standard is if you're in a protection zone, the answer is no. If you're in a development zone, it's yes, providing that there is no net loss or effect on that species.
So, if you're in the development zone, is the policy identical for everything on the list at the end of this policy?
Yes.
Okay, and so that a species that was totally developed dependent on the highlands for survival, and if it were in an area, that area would not be a development zone at all. Is that the difference? Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Yes.
We better write this so that real people can understand.
And it's in later, the difficulty is there's two sets of standards. There's a set of standards that informs the map, and then there's a set of standards that informs all site plan reviews. And the resources may bridge zones.
Why don't you keep going through this and see.
Yeah. But Michael would suggest that you define that each time you mention it, just so that we don't have a lot.
Item number five, when for purposes of informing the land use capability map, endangered and threatened species are also used as a regional watershed indicator. We talked about this under open waters. We use it as an indication of habitat quality to identify those watersheds that are important habitat or provide habitat for species that are important indicators of watershed integrity. Item number six, again, to inform the map, we're using threatened endangered species, and we discussed this earlier, under riparian areas to identify those riparian areas that have high ecological integrity. Using water or wetland dependent rare, threatened, and endangered species as indicators of habitat quality. Item number seven is now how does this information, resource information, define the map? What we're acknowledging is that the regional protection zone will be identified to will include the critical habitat resource area. That is the subset of all habitat that represents the most regionally significant habitat. Most significant habitat within the region. Not all, just the most significant.
Question, what is the definition of concentration then in this area? Is there a mass?
In the resource area?
Yeah.
It's the smallest area that it accounts for 90% of the habitat that is necessary for those species that depend upon the region for their survival. Not all species. That's where this thing gets placed. Now, that might change as we're constantly, as we're integrating layers, and the reason on some of these breaks are preliminary, they're still in development.
But that should be fine.
Yeah. Yes, it will.
And can we do what was suggested of actually showing that on a map? The 100, the 90, the...
I will...
I mean, just for discussion purposes.
I would say... As we show you the map, if the council has maybe a couple of things that are most important to see with ranges, that would be the most we could contemplate, because if we do this on more than just a very few limited things, we will be in peril.
But also, I thought you said you don't have the information show 100%. Anyway, right?
Well, not today. I mean, it's all done, but it's...
I think what we'd like to do is to show you it, integrate, explain why, and then loop back to any specifics that you might have based on what we show you when it's integrated, and then we could potentially entertain a very limited number.
No, that's reasonable. Yeah. I just didn't know what your answer was.
We are capable and able of expressing the data, dicing it and slicing it in as many ways as the council would like. The issue is time. And so in the interest of time, staff is providing its recommendation based upon what they feel is most consistent and scientifically consistent with the literature and most scientifically defensible.
And your input through the work sessions today.
Item number eight. So these now speak to site plan review standards that would be considered during a site plan application. Please recognize that just because you're in the protection zone isn't a prohibition on all development. It severely restricts the type and nature of the development, but it's not a prohibition. So there will be site plan application reviews in every zone. Within the protection zone, the goal is to prohibit any uses, any change of an existing use of land that would alter habitat for an endangered, threatened, or rare species. That's all habitat. Not just the regionally significant. It includes the bald eagle here. The bald eagle is now included. So it is prohibit new land uses or the alteration of existing land uses in the regional protection that would alter or be detrimental to the ecological integrity of a critical habitat. Not the critical habitat resource area or the highlands resource area, but all habitat. Secondly, is identify opportunities where the restoration enhancement of previously impaired critical habitat resource area are feasible and appropriate. When you talk management and mitigation, where you're actually asking people to make improvements on the ground, we're trying to direct those management strategies towards restoring and enhancing the most important and valuable. If you're protecting trees, you don't want to protect the trees necessarily in the middle of a development zone, which might have aesthetic value but not ecological value. You'd want to protect those trees and manage those trees within your forest resource area. This is the same concept.
I have a question here on that. We will identify those opportunities, but we will not require that.
In
is that right?
Yes. Later, if the council deems that a development application encroaching within habitat is appropriate based upon a mitigation proposal, like they're going to cut down 10 trees and they're going to plant 10 trees, the requirement for identifying where those trees will be planted, the identifying where those trees will be planted is a requirement for approval. So in effect, it is a requirement that they must demonstrate how they're going to restore, enhance, or mitigate the losses.
That should be clarified. Yes.
It is as you get into development standards.
Mr. Chairman, this brings up a question that I didn't have before. I thought this second bullet was saying in previously impaired critical habitat resource areas, because of previous development, not a site application,
Correct.
A current development,
yes.
That's
correct.
Where we're going to also have opportunities identified for restoration.
Yes, this is to identify proactively areas that would be appropriate for restoration or enhancement.
So the answer that you gave about
an application coming forward, like cutting down trees and planting trees, that's more of a mitigation situation. What we're talking about here is more than that, right? We're talking about identifying opportunities for restoring critical habitat.
But Jack, what Jack was asking was, is this a requirement of the municipality to conform? And we're saying, in effect, it becomes a requirement through development.
Tracy's point is exactly right as well. Yeah. It's not just pre-existing. It's if somebody's going to affect the environment, the habitat, then it has to be mitigated.
Yes.
Well, the first point essentially says that.
That's true.
Well, I was just wording the first point. The prohibit anything that would alter or be detrimental. I assume detrimental is enough. That if it's going to improve the habitat, we're not going to prohibit that.
Correct.
So it's just taking out the word alter.
Could I ask what kind of things that we would do to restore a critical habitat so that animals that used to be there aren't there now, they would come back? What would we do?
An example is a northern goshawk. Forest interior bird species, very susceptible to disturbance from humans and fragmentation of forest. Mitigation would be to plant trees in existing clearings to connect forest patches, to make a larger contiguous patch of forest that could be used by that species. That's a form of mitigation. Grassland birds, you can eliminate shrubs and plant grasses that are more conducive to the breeding requirements of those species. So it depends, it's species dependent. Some there's very little.
So how do we pick what species? And then if it needs restoration, I mean, it's because something isn't there anymore, probably.
Correct.
So how do we pick what we want to put back there?
And that's part of it, is to identify where those opportunities exist so that you can inform where it's best and what type of activity would be necessary, like planting trees or removing shrubs or getting rid of invasive
but
species.
But we don't know what we want to bring back. I mean, let's say that this big field is, you know, it's the total pervious coverage on the thing, totally impervious.
Yeah, and these would be, in a lot of cases, and it's discussed later, is species specific. So if you want to, like, manage for forested wildlife, you manage forest. Forest doesn't help grassland birds or aquatic species. If you want to manage for aquatic species...
But we would just pick something, say, I want to bog turtle here, so I'll do this.
Yeah, well, it's not that...
I would think you'd be guided to some extent by what used to be there.
Yeah, yes.
What is there but is impaired.
Exactly.
Yes.
When you want to enhance the habitat.
Yes.
There's a lot of data sources for that.
Yeah,
sightings, a lot of studies.
I mean, what used to be...
Yes, and what's imperiled as... What's imperiled and what needs to be.
Yeah, we know where the species distributions are. We also know where there's gaps within that distribution of habitat. We know what that altered habitat is and where there's opportunities for restoration. That's not difficult to do on a species by species level. This is just the acknowledgement that it's an important component of the plan.
Keep going, Steve.
Item number three is just to prioritize acquisition, development restrictions, and to acknowledge the TDR, use of TDR credit bonuses for the protection of critical habitat. Item number nine,
the sentence is clear. The second line, you're talking about within both critical habitat resource, both plural resource area, singular.
Within both is an extra word.
Should be areas.
Yeah, within critical habitat resource area.
Both.
Yeah, both is deleted. Sorry. Regional conservation zone, item number one. These are standards that apply to all uses within the regional conservation zone. That is the intermediate zone. Again, to prohibit uses that would be detrimental, delete alter. Identify opportunities where restoration and enhancement of critical habitat is feasible.
And require it.
That it's a required under site standards that you'll see later. And then in cases of regional conservation zone, wherein earlier we're prioritizing acquisition and development restrictions, now we're encouraging or requiring protection and restoration plans. So this is, if a community wants to accommodate low-density residential development within the regional conservation zone, then they have to develop a protection and restoration plan for those species of concern, as well as low-impact development, BMPs. Item number 10, this is the development zone. Now, we can have habitat. Again, this acknowledges that we might have habitat in the development zone. Here, we're discouraging adjustments or any changes to critical habitat that would impair that the survival of that species. Secondly, we're requiring the use of plans and low-impact development BMPs to minimize, avoid, or, if necessary, mitigate for those in that.
Okay, Steve, explain how that would apply to a TDR receiving area, how we would do these two things.
Well, within a TDR receiving area, let's say you have a forest patch, within an area that is otherwise deemed appropriate for TDR receiving. The council would deem that impact acceptable based upon a mitigation plan that would essentially plant trees at an alternate location. Ideally, that alternate location would be identified as an area appropriate for restoration by the council.
Is there a difference between, adjustments and revisions to the critical habitat in a development zone are conditionally acceptable provided the restoration plan is included? Is there a difference between that and discourage operationally?
I don't think operationally there's any difference. But. Item number 11. Right now, we start making transitions from uses, standards that relate to all uses within a zone. Now these are standards that relate to all site plan applications, regardless of zone. All right, these are the site design standards. There are three types of site design standards, resource protection being the first one. Again, the resource protection standards prohibit clearing of vegetation or disturbance to soils within the area designated critical habitat that would alter or that would be detrimental to the survival of a species of concern. So regardless of what zone you're in, there's a standard that says you cannot alter habitat if it's going to be detrimental to the survival of the species.
Shouldn't we also put in there or disturbance of soils or changes to related ground and surface waters? Because often that will...
Yeah, hydrology.
Okay. So if you could insert that phrase.
This gets to your issue here, is that just because it's in the development zone that may allow an alteration with a mitigation plan,
mm-hmm.
There's still a bar that's set that says you can't do anything if it's going to compromise the survival of the species.
Right.
So first you have to demonstrate that there's no compromise to the survival before you can move forward. Mm-hmm. If you can make that demonstration through a mitigation plan in the development zone, it's consistent with the standards in that zone, therefore the council could approve a plan that allows for impact to a habitat with mitigation. And essentially, so it's a graduated tier of standards that are most strict in the highest resource areas and gradually less strict but not less protective in the development area. Item number 2 is prohibit adjustments or revisions to critical habitat protection requirements except as necessary to protect public health and safety or provide for minimum practical use in the absence of any alternative. This recognizes that there is going to be conditions for public health safety and for minimum uses. This is the waiver concept we talked about a little bit the other day. The following smart design standards are...
I have a bullet to suggest there. This is where perhaps I look to see where it would go. I think this is where the bullet would go that I mentioned earlier about allowing for the expansion of a critical habitat upon demonstration of the need for protection for a certain species. And I think it would also go under 12 and 13, but if that's the right place for it, I think that concept needs to be put in there.
Item number 12, smart design standards. So this is how the requirements for how you lay out a design of a property, essentially, that that seeks to meet the protection requirements or the protection standards, depending on what your zone you're in. Item number one is really you're limiting development activities to critical habitat, to maintenance of pre-existing uses, no increase in clearing of vegetation or disturbance to soil or alteration to hydrology would be permitted. Prioritization for restoration of impaired areas shall be required wherever practical. Relief from strict adherence to resource protection standards above shall be permitted only within areas approved by the Highlands Council as a specially planned area. Acquisition or restoration of impaired areas within the critical habitat resource areas shall be in coverage wherever practical.
So in case of a TDR, that would quite the receiving area would likely be a specially planned area, right? And that's how
correct
this would deal with that point. That
yes, that there's an acknowledgement. The first bar is no development activities, no clearing of vegetation, disturbance of soil, alteration of hydrology. Except, and then the rest of it is when do the accepts apply? This is specially planned areas would be an exception. But even if you're within a specially planned area, you have to adhere to the resource protection standards, which says you can't alter it if it's going to compromise the survival. Item number two is establish minimum requirements for development approval of low-impact development BMPs. Three is to require preparation inclusion of critical habitat protection restoration plans within municipal zoning and land use ordinances. If a municipality has habitat, part of conformance will be how are you going to deal with that habitat alteration within areas that are appropriate for growth or development. Next item, establish minimum requirements for incorporation of critical habitat stewardship management plans with municipal and county open space plans. This acknowledges that there is an obligation as part of stewardship and management of open space to maintain the habitat for threatened and endangered species. Don't build ball fields where the bald eagle is. Require inventory of rare, threatened, or endangered species within a critical habitat area for any site or portion thereof as a mandatory requirement for any site plan application. Tim, this gets to your issue. We don't know where all the habitat is. If you're in the habitat area or in an area that may be suitable in Tracy's expansion, they have to do an inventory as part of site plan application. This is also consistent with the DEP standards within the preservation area through their rules. Item number 13, regional growth standards, is the requirement for participation in regional critical habitat conservation and management plans. As part of earlier, the zone definition within the protection area is to identify areas that may be appropriate for restoration or improvement, prioritization on acquisition. That could be all put together in a regional critical habitat conservation and management plan. So a municipality knows, you know, here's what the area that's important, here's what we can do in order to mitigate for losses as a result of development, and here's the guidance that we provide to developers that come to the town that want to seek approval under a mitigation plan. So essentially, it's upfront identification of where and what is appropriate to manage for species of concern.
I have a question. Where you apply the regional growth standards, we're always applying the smart design standards, right?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Then we don't need to repeat the bullets.
Yes. These don't stand independent. Item number 14, pre-conformance strategies. The acknowledgement that technical guidelines for and procedures for developing critical habitat stewardship plans as part of open space plans has to be developed prior to initiation of conformance, as does guidelines for critical habitat protection and restoration plans. So those are two new concepts that will require detailed guidelines to enable a municipality to conform. As well as a reiteration of low-impact development BMPs, which is consistent with other resource elements of the plan as well.
Steve, I think you have a lot of different plans going on here, which all sound very similar. So you just said, I thought you said in the regional growth standards, you said the critical habitat conservation and management plan is one that addressed both site-specific requirements as well as municipal or sub-regional planning. And I'm just looking at the glossary. I mean, what you're saying here is you're going to develop guidelines for plans that would be developed by public agencies, in essence, like by municipal or county entities that are broader than the site. That's the conformance requirement.
I think it was always envisioned that regional plans would be largely developed with the cooperation of the municipalities by the Highlands Council. So that may be through grants, but regional, by definition, requires multi-municipal participation. So regional, the use of the word regional planning concepts there is would be driven by the Highlands Council staff. That would be something that we would develop as ongoing through pre-conformance, conformance. We would give it to the town with and do it, develop it in collaboration with the town or towns that are affected by that plan. The critical, the stewardship plans, the protection and restoration plans are more municipal specific. So that's taking regional concepts and applying it within their municipality, that a municipality would have to then develop and adopt as part of their municipal zoning or land use ordinances. So the concept of regional, we talked about it, regional stormwater wetland mitigation plans, I'm forgetting what the other regional plans we were talking about earlier. But
wetlands protection.
The stormwater management, wetland mitigation, critical habitat conservation and management would all be plans that would largely be developed by the council with the cooperation and participation of municipalities. Mm-hmm. And it would be developed during conformance, ongoing conformance.
Your thought is the council would develop the plan? I guess you're setting up a situation where you're allowing certain activities that may impact upon a resource conditioned upon the idea that they're going to mitigate in the context of a plan.
Yeah.
The plans, as I heard you describe them, might occur at the site level, so it might be might lose a quarter acre of wetlands over here if you replant on this end of the site, so there's an offset. Then you talk about a municipal-based plan, in which you want the site planning reviews to fit into that context.
Correct.
And then there's a regional plan, which is multiple municipalities.
Correct. And the municipal plan may just be a subset of the regional plan. If you look at item number 13.
You hope it would be.
Yes,
right.
If everything works out fine.
Or it doesn't make any sense to do it that way. So you're saying that you're suggesting the policy be that as a requirement of performance, at the municipal level plan, as well as the planning process to require that during site plan review, those are the two required elements, and that supra municipal would be a burden that the council itself would take on to organize and develop and coordinate.
Yes, and the policy is that if it's available and where it's applicable, that participation is mandatory. But it acknowledges that it might take 5 years to develop those regional plans. And until they're developed, then only the local plans would apply.
Right, but as a matter of conformity, you're suggesting that the municipalities need to make provision for mandatory participation in that.
Once the council approves a regional plan, they must participate in that regional plan. That's essentially what item 13 means.
Okay. I guess I see two out of the three plans in the pre-conformance strategy.
Pre-conformance is just the two plans, the municipally based plans, the guidelines. You go to conformance, again, it's the two plans that have to be developed during conformance. You go to the five-year resource, and there's that regional plan. Because it's going to take a long time to develop some of these management strategies.
Mr. Chair, I'll just say, just as a general point, I think the policies are the right ones. I think they're good ones that are consistent with the Act. And, aside from the details that we talked about, but one of the things, which goes to Mimi's point, is in a way that the RMP ought to be a source of information and requirements that it's going to be implemented at different levels and through different vehicles. And I think that as this iteration goes through and you develop the draft, the language needs to be clearer. You know, you use the terms standards fairly broadly. We talk about policies, we talk about management strategies, we talk about standards. And usually in the regulatory lexicon, standards mean something very specific. And it's not clear sometimes in this language, except after listening to you discuss it, how you envision it to be implemented. Now, this will be a requirement for the municipalities to include in their performance plans. This will be a requirement at the site plan level. And sometimes it floats back and forth and just needs a little bit of polishing, I think. But that's,
I wonder if when we see the final plan and all these things are plugged in to the places they belong, it might be clearer. But I would just add to Tim's comments that I think sometimes we may be unnecessarily creating new jargon and lexicons that, you'd have to refer to the glossary to have any understanding of what it means, and that would be general advice I'd give on the actual, and to the editing committee to inform, to think about.
I have a question for Dante or Tom, and this has to do with funding for municipalities ongoing when an application comes before them in an area that needs restoration of a critical habitat area or whatever. They don't really have experts, municipalities, in these areas. You know, they're really going to have to go out and hire, the kind of technical people that they need to develop a BMP plan.
Yes.
Is there going to be money available for that type of support?
Yes. The acknowledgement is where there is a conformance requirement that would and where it applies, that would qualify them for recovery of costs.
So
under the grant program,
to us and we'd have to send them the money so that they can get there.
We would, as a part of the guidelines, it would specify the qualifications that are necessary to prepare a plan. As part of the special grants, incentive grants that Ross talked about, there is a large pool of money that's set aside just for development of those type of planning.
This is on an ongoing basis as applications come in.
Yep. Well, on the application level, normally planning boards have a series of specialists on retainer or under contract with the town. We may even specify what minimum qualifications are in conformance. Like, you have to have a hydrogeologist, you have to have a aquatic or terrestrial ecologist, you have to have a landscape architecture, you have to have a planner as well as an engineer, you should have an environmental engineer as well as a civil engineer. So a town has access to minimum qualified individuals under the municipal land use law. Those costs for reviewing applications are borne by the applicant themselves. But at least the town then has access to the appropriate level of expertise to deal with different aspects of a plan that will come up. Not all issues will come up with every site. But
just in support of what Tim said before, when you get to policy 17, you're recommending that the council work with DEP and Fish and Wildlife Service to inventory and develop management plans of species of concern. It's not clear how those plans fit in with the plans we're requiring municipalities and counties to develop.
Yeah, well, that would inform the management plans under the 5-year protection planning goals, which is the regional conservation and management plans. The protection plans, protection and restoration plans, essentially is very municipal specific. They may have to be revised over time as more information becomes available. Part of the difficulty is some of these things will take years and they will evolve over time. But we have to put temporary measures in place at a municipal to get a municipality to start thinking in those terms. The initial plan may be based upon very minimal information, but at least it starts the process. And that it might build and be revised and updated over time as more and more information becomes available. Item number 18 or 17.
Wait, I had something on 16.
Yes.
To add a bullet, the one piece I see missing here is For the restoration of critical habitat in absence of an application for a development project. So I think, you know, if we add a bullet that says encourage the restoration of habitat based on these inventories that are going to be prepared for and or state or highlands data through support from the council and partnering of municipal county entities and nonprofits, just so there's another vehicle for restoration of critical habitat other than development.
Well, I think you had that. It's in policies 8 and 9 to identify opportunities for the restoration and enhancement of previous...
Right, to identify. But when I asked about that, they said, yeah, the reason to identify is when you have an application come in, you want to know where those areas are so you don't have to invent it then. So what I'm saying is that we should have some proactive efforts separate from development project applications that will work towards restoring critical habitat.
That's a great point.
Thank you.
Item number 17, again, consistent regulatory review on permit applications with the department and continued coordination for development of these management protection plans with the appropriate agencies as well, including U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which has jurisdictional oversight on federally listed species.
Just sort of one detailed comment on that, which is, when you structure, when you go forward in detailing out what these plans will involve, you should reflect the requirements of those programs. Because there are,
yes,
it goes to opening the doors to federal money flowing, right? There's a conservation reserve enhancement program,
yes,
which acts to, you know, restore wetlands buffers. There's programs for grassland management. So we want to make sure that we tee this up as well as possible to have that money flow into the region to be available to actually implement these programs.
And complement the implementation of the regional master plan.
Right, absolutely.
Local participation considerations, education and information and technical assistance for how does a municipality develop a critical habitat protection and restoration plan? That's going to be an education process. And how does a municipality develop and implement stewardship plans for publicly held properties? Again, these are new concepts that are going to be alien to a lot of municipalities. It's going to require continued education and support to implement at a local level.
Particularly on the second bullet, maybe I'll both that add county officials. Okay. Well, any other comments on this? See if people have specific comments.
Excuse me, Chairman, I just have a basic question. Hopefully you can address this for me, Steve. With regards to the critical habitat, the indexing, Appendix A and B, how current is this list?
The animal list is current to date, 2006. The plants are, I believe, current through 2005.
Okay.
We're still going back and forth on the plans. There's some discrepancies we're trying to reconcile with the department.
Okay.
But the December 2005 is on the plan.
Okay. Thank you. It's 10 of 1. Let's come back at 1:30 and tackle PDR.
You did good. Yeah, this will be a fun one.